Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon, and welcome to the panel. It's always dangerous to do something just after lunch, so it's up to the panelists to keep this very interesting and entertaining. As Guy mentioned, my name is Rahul Chalang. I'm a professor of information systems at Carnegie Mellon, and I think my co-author just talked a little bit about the book, which is, you know, how the data is changing the entertainment industry. So in the same spirit, the title for the today's panel is Data Analytics Converting Elusive Science to Practical Business Application. I think we all agree that data and database decision making is going to play an increasingly important role in the entertainment industry. Maybe we all also agree that our industry is not at the cutting edge of what we see as some of the technology firms are, whether it's Amazon or Google or Netflix, where maybe some of the data-driven decision-making is embedded more deeply into some of the business processes and business decisions they make. Maybe they hire and train people who can interpret and who can use the data more directly into some of the decisions they make. And I think some of the questions that we want to explore in our panel is that what are some of the challenges that the entertainment firms have? Is it that the entertainment firms are predominantly driven by creative processes and product creation and hard data and data science? Maybe there is a little bit of tension there where it is difficult to assimilate some of those insights back into content production? Or is it that it's just harder to change some of those legacy systems that we have been operating on for a very long time? So those are some of the interesting and important questions I want to bring together. Hopefully our panelists will be able to solve most of these problems. But it's a great pleasure. We have excellent set of panelists, and I'll ask them to briefly introduce themselves and just kind of tell a little bit about possibly some of the work that they have been doing, which is directly relevant to the title of our panel.
Well, I'm Wayne Peacock. I run analytics at the Walt Disney Studios. Let's see, areas of focus for us. The studio at Disney is really broken up into four groups. We have a theatrical team, a home entertainment team, a music group, and a stage team. And I run a centralized analytics team that works with folks across all four of those different groups, primarily, though, our theatrical and home entertainment teams. And I spend a lot of time working with marketing folks and working with PR folks and different folks across different aspects of operations to try to help them leverage data and analytics to hopefully make better decisions.
Hi, everybody. My name is Fabio Luzzi. I've been in Viacom for 6 years. I lead a team of data scientists. It's an agile, as I like to call it, agile team of 10 people. And basically, the idea is we work at a corporate level across all the business units and all the brands. And the idea is to help pretty much everybody answer their questions and achieve their goals using data and advanced analytics. So our typical clients are research. We work a lot with research, marketing, programming, scheduling, acquisition. But the idea really is to help anybody using advanced analytics. So our main goal is to, as you saw, democratize data. That's one of the main goals. But obviously, we do a lot of ad hoc analytics. Not everything can become an application. Sometimes it's just a one-time thing. But and also one of the main goals is translate statistics into English so everybody can understand. Obviously, I don't do that because my English is okay.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to be here. My name is Dominic Hansens, and I'm a professor of marketing here at the Anderson School of Management, practically next door at UCLA. I've been there for several years, and my research and teaching and consulting have always focused, in essence, on one question, is how does marketing impact business performance? And I've used a very, very data-centric approach, which is why I'm here, and have observed over the years with tremendous personal pleasure and satisfaction that the data environment has improved so much. things that we could only dream of 10 years ago are now everyday reality. Whether or not decisions have improved that much, that's still an open question. Hopefully we'll discuss that a little bit this afternoon. But I represent the academic sector, but I've also done a fair amount of work in industry through various consulting projects and through starting or being a co-founder of a marketing analytics company several years ago.
Okay, so, you know, since morning we have heard many different data analytics systems projects that have been implemented across various firms. And I'm curious what the panelists think about, in the sense that, is there an example you can provide where some of the output of the data analytics actually feeds into some important business decision where, you know, either your firm or at least you know somebody who instituted this program and those insights actually made a difference, or at least they were taken and affected the business decision making within the firm? So I'm very curious to hear whether, you know, there's a good concrete example that you can, so whoever wants to go.
So I do have an example. Thank you for the question. So, as you know, not everything that airs on TV is original programming, right? So a lot of it, it's from acquired content. So a classical example is Friends. Everybody loves Friends. It's, you know, obviously it's not original anymore, but it's still airing on many networks, including some of the Viacom networks. So that's an example of acquisition, right? So the Viacom, and I'm sure many other television companies spend a lot of money in acquiring non-original content. So, you know, they because obviously there is so much content that you can produce to fill, you know, 20 hours or whatever it is, 24 hours on the air. So they buy a lot of non-original content. Friends or French Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, or you know what I mean. So the point is, okay, so how do they make the decision of buying a specific content? How do they know that that content is going to perform well on their channel? So let's say, for example, BET, Black Entertainment Television, they I'm just giving an example. They may think of acquiring Blackish or Scandal. How do they know that that show that has been airing already, probably many times, probably repeated already for hundreds of times, how do they know that that show is going to perform well? They're going to spend millions of dollars buying the rights of that show. How do they? So obviously there is a dedicated team. There is an acquisition team that runs a lot of reports, duplication, overlap, whatever they run, to, you know, to get data and decide ultimately, okay, let's spend this million or billion of dollars and let's buy the program. So what we did is we created an acquisition model. It's basically a model, a statistical model, that uses machine learning techniques, and if you want to fall asleep, I can go into the details. But basically, the model at the end spits out if the show is gonna perform above or below the network average ratings. So obviously, nobody's gonna decide whether to spend millions of dollars on acquiring a show only based on a model, right? But it's certainly an extra tool in their toolbox that now they have, based on, you know, on scientific algorithms that can predict more or less how the show is going to perform. So that model is having business impacts, because now the acquisition team uses it next to all their traditional analytical methodologies to decide whether a show is going to buy or not a show. And a classical example. And I hope I'm not going to get fired. I don't think so if I say this, but like How I Met Your Mother is a classic example of a bad acquisition. Like, it was a great show. It performed really well, but it was a fiasco for all the networks that acquired it as a non-original programming. Nobody thought of that. Everybody thought it was going to be a good acquisition. It was a failure. The model could have helped them predict that. That's a good example.
How about you, Dominic? Maybe even outside the entertainment industry, because you hear about a lot of these models, but then you look at whether the models are directly implemented or even evaluated, like how good those models are.
Sure. Well, given the audience, I did prepare an example in the in at least one sector of the entertainment industry, and that's video games, which have some similarity to, for example, motion pictures and television shows in the sense that the big decisions are made before launch, the big investments, and you don't really know anything until after launch. I was part of the team that built a model on what are the factors that drive success or failure as measured by sales of video games. And as you can imagine, it's the usual drivers. But one thing that was really quite interesting is, yes, we were able to find, let's say, the effects, the marginal effects of advertising spending. So if you double the ad budget, how many more units do you sell? That sort of question was relatively straightforward to answer. But the more interesting question was, you have access in that industry to some expert opinion about how good the product is. And that's in the form of these sort of professional 16, 17-year-old video players or game players. They're nocturnal animals, okay? They only live at night, and these guys are really good, okay? And so they would scale any new product on a scale from 1 to 10 about how good the game is. Turns out when you input that little metric in a model of success, you get a tremendously strong relationship, even controlling for everything else, distribution, advertising, category, and whatnot. And so the importance for the organization was as follows. Rather than constantly focus attention on the after launch or after the production decision is made question about how much should we spend on advertising and where should we spend it, take a look at the relative importance of product development in the sense that if you know the expected performance of a game that gets a 7 out of 10 score by these, quote, experts, and you get suggestions from the expert to make it an 8 out of 10, okay? Well, can you calculate the monetary value of being a 7 versus an 8 on a 10-point scale? Yes, you can. That translates into a certain number, several million dollars, incidentally. So you can now make a product development decision that says, don't launch this product, send it back to the lab, do some more product development work, do some more engineering work, okay? Come back 3 months later with a million dollars later, okay? With an 8, okay, now launch it with an appropriate marketing budget. And the combination of the creative appeal as we were able to measure, as well as the marketing support, not only provide a very, very good predictive model, but also help the organization think about the creative side in an investment sense, as opposed to just something that was done and cannot be recovered.
What do you like to say?
Well, I'll go at the other end of the spectrum. So in the movie business, one of the biggest challenges that the studio faces is that we don't actually own the conversion event at the end. So we spend lots of money in development, taking these great ideas, putting them together, making them come alive on screen, lots and lots more money marketing those films, and then at the end of the day, we don't actually sell the tickets, exhibitors sell the tickets. And the same thing happens as that movie moves out of the exhibition window into the home entertainment window. It's our distribution partners, our retail partners, digital, physical, et cetera, they're the ones that own those conversion events with the customer. So the challenge for us up front is trying to help our marketing folks and our PR folks understand how our fans are engaging with content before that opening window, that opening weekend release, because that so much of what happens downstream is all driven off of a big successful upfront release. So if you have a big giant blockbuster, the tail on that is much more impactful in downstream channels than a smaller film, as you can imagine. So we spend a lot of time trying to understand how the free samples that we make and give away, the trailers that we make and put into the marketplace, are engaging fans, and what they say about the content, how we can feed that back to our marketing folks, and how we can help them better reach the fans that they're not reaching. Because when you think about a big film like a Rogue One, which is going to open in December, you know, it's got to have broad appeal. It's got to engage audiences across all four quadrants in order for it to be successful for the studio. So our job is to help them leverage the data, the rich data that's available in the digital domain, particularly around social data, and bring that back to bear against more traditional research work that is done, and complement that research in a way that gives us a better insight into what's working and what's not working, what's engaging fans, what's not engaging them, which characters do they resonate with, which ones do they not. That sort of thing, and all of that, you know, is the virtuous circle that we feed into the cycle. And then we also use that same process to try to understand how our film is going to operate in a marketplace that's crowded by lots of entertainment choices. So it could be the release of a new game on a weekend that is gonna that a major film is gonna open on, or it could be a major sporting event like we had when Age of Ultron opened on the same weekend as Mayweather-Pacquiao. So a big part of what my team will do is look at the data and look at the composition of audiences and try to help the marketing teams understand where the audience overlap might be between competing events that are going to compete for the eyeballs of that consumer on the weekend, and understand how they might either be able to lean into that or pivot their marketing to be able to address the overlap that exists there. So that's an example on the other end.
So the other theme that we heard even in the morning and probably in other places as well is that how do you organize data analytics or data science? Is it centralized? Is it work like a consultant's where they go and, you know, help different business units make decision? Is it deeply integrated within each of the unit? And supposedly how you're organized probably play a big role in the stakeholders buying the results of your analysis, adopting them, and making them more or less successful. So I'm curious to hear, within your firm, how are you organized? And you feel that that's the optimal way, or you know things could have been a little bit more different, or if they were a little more different, then they would have a larger impact within the firm?
Well, I think it's a process. So, I mean, I can certainly talk about how we're organized today, but you guys probably already heard the answer earlier from your colleague. But, you know, there's really, in my mind, there's three models. You can be entirely decentralized, you can be entirely centralized, or you can adopt some sort of a hybrid model, and they all have virtues associated with them. The way things are set up today, but I would say it's always an evolving landscape for us, is we have a centralized team, and then we have a bunch of decentralized folks that are spread out across the business. We have a lot of, you know, because of the nature of the way the Walt Disney Company is put together, we also have folks that do analytics all over the company as well. And so each of those different groups also bring unique skills and perspectives to the table that we will fit together for different business purposes. So for instance, we have folks from you know, our data science team that's based out of our Parks and Resorts group, working with our theatrical finance folks, working on marketing optimization, for instance. That might be an example. So we will cobble things together as necessary to put the best skills against the best problem that we can. So you know, I think the role that we try to play in the center is we try to take care of the things that would benefit everyone across the studio. So we work very closely with our engineering partners to make sure that our data platforms and the access to data is there, that the tools and technologies that need to be in place are in place, that we have governance around the data and that we understand where the data came from and that it's got good data quality associated with it. I do have a data science function within my team, and so we work very closely with practitioners of data science and other parts of the business to try to look for commonality around tools and techniques and make sure that we have a community, because I think it's important to have that. But I also think there's a lot of benefit to having folks embedded directly with the business folks that have the problem at the line of scrimmage that they're trying to solve for. That deep subject matter expertise is hard to replicate in an entirely centralized function, which is why I think the hybrid model makes so much sense. So I think the art in that is making sure that you're kind of loosely coupled between the embedded resources and the centralized resources, but you're aligning a community across all the different practice areas so that you're not replicating inefficiently, I guess, those services across the different functions that you support.
So I'll come to you in a minute, but if I were to just put you on the spot, if I ask you one criticism to this model, what would you say? Maybe it's optimal for your firm.
Well, no, I think if I were going to point to something today, I don't know that I would describe it as a criticism as much as I would describe what can be challenging in that model. So one of the things that's challenging in that model is when you have folks embedded, you know, with different business functions, they get very deeply aligned with those functions, and sometimes it's hard to get everybody to kind of step up out of their function and want to collaborate together for something that would be for the greater good of everyone else. And it's not because people aren't willing or don't have the appetite for or not good good human beings. It's just because, you know, it's that conflict and trade-off between the work that they have to do down inside the business function that they're embedded with and the time and energy it takes to coordinate with a group of folks to build something that may serve the greater good holistically, but trade that off against the time associated with developing a point solution right there that would meet their needs. And so I think that's one of the challenges. There's probably others as well. But I think, you know, that's one of the biggest challenges that I see in that kind of a model.
Have you?
So I think I was thinking, right, so it depends what you want to do with data science, I think. So if, and I think there are two possible things. So if you want to create innovation or if you want to just automate things that are already existing.
So improve the productivity versus...
Yeah. So I think if you want to create innovation, you need a centralized group of data scientists, maybe with an hybrid. I think hybrid is the best solution. But the reason why is because, you know, a data science, you have to think that a data science is someone that wants to be surrounded by other data scientists. They want to speak to people that understand them. It's nerds, right? So if isolated data scientists, they're not going to work because their boss don't understand what they're saying, or, you know, they don't get inspired by other people like them. So I think it's very important to have one team of data scientists that everybody refers to. And then it's also good to have, you know, some isolated data scientists across the organization, as long as they work together, because at the end of the day, what you want to avoid, you want to avoid people, different people in different groups working on the same thing. So that's why there should be one group of data scientists that is working on something that everybody knows of and people can contribute to it. So an hybrid model, I think, is the best. Also because you need to keep contact with, you know, all the business units across the organization. But it's important to have one centralized group where all the data science can meet and refer to, that they speak the same language, they get inspired. And I think someone mentioned today in one of the panel that the leader of the data science group should be someone who codes. I think it's important to have like a hands-on leader that really understand your challenges, your problems. So I think it's more efficient when the group of data scientists, it's made of all data scientists, right? From the junior person to the vice president. So yeah, so I think an hybrid model, as Wayne said, I think that's the best solution. I don't think a decentralized model would work because you would end up having different people working on similar things. They are isolated, so they don't speak to, you know, other data scientists. So yeah, I would say an hybrid model is the best.
So you mentioned earlier that the centralized model is more suitable for innovation sort of activities. In Viacom, is that something, an important component, or its more focus is on the productivity improvement, that is, improve your decisions versus try to hit, you know,
no,
big
we're
home?
Definitely working on innovation, creating innovation. So, you know, obviously not everything, that's not 100% of what we do, right? So I would say, you know, we work 50% on creating new things and 50% on maintaining or improving what's existing. But definitely innovation is a big focus, yeah.
So Dominic, based on your studies, is there a model that you think works better, or really there is just no answer? It depends from context to context.
Well, I'm not an organization specialist academically, but it is my understanding that the field has not sort of converged to one unique model that's best. So we're all experimenting, but I do think we have a couple of interesting organizing principles, and I think it'll dovetail with what's been said earlier. So number one is the principle that ideally information is centralized, and action is decentralized. Okay, so think about this as a principle. Now, why is that? You want to centralize information because you want people to have full access when important decisions are made. You don't want them to guess. You want them to at least have access to the information, especially in headquarters. So there needs to be sharing, and therefore there's probably like a central server or something that serves everybody. Why does action need to be decentralized? Well, because you want to be close to your customers. And if you have action about seeking distribution in Portugal, you need a Portuguese specialist to do that. He or she will know best what's best for the local market. So that's sort of a principle that helps us think about these things. In terms of where the data scientists fit in, you know, I do agree with what has been said. But let me make one point in favor of a little bit of a mixing model, which also has been said, which is that in as far as these data centers, scientists sit in teams with decision makers, with managers, their influence is likely to be higher because they're very, very close to where the decision is made. Okay, and again, in this day and age, just because the decision is made here doesn't mean that the data has to be there. The data can be centralized. That's not a problem. But I want to end with my comment with one example that really struck me by its uniqueness. And think about this a little bit. This came up about 6-7 months ago. There is evidently a private equity firm in Hong Kong that, and I believe this is a first, that has put a model, you know, a mathematical model on its board of directors. Okay, so think about that. So you have the usual board, let's say 7 people. So there are 6 people, and then there's a model, maybe a laptop or something, that sits there, and that has a vote. Okay, that to me is a wonderful illustration of the importance of mixing the human source of information and the data, and takes it all the way to the highest level of decision-making, which is the board of directors. So it could be the tie-breaking vote, for example, in case the humans are split over whether or not to fund, let's say, a motion picture project. So I'll end on those.
I think we are pretty far away from there, probably.
They've done it. one firm has done it.
So I think we have heard this many times, but let me ask it again. What are some of the challenges you feel, that is, as a data science operations within the firms, what are the key fundamental challenges you think that the firm has? Is it the data? Is it the buy-in from the stakeholders? Is it the talent? What is, from your vantage point, what do you see is the challenge of data analytics or selling data analytics within the firm as...
Well, I don't think it's hard to sell it, at least at Disney, I don't think it is. We're really fortunate. I think we have a number of key people in key positions in different business functions who really believe in the value of data and believe in the value of analytics. I think we're still looking for the places where we can have the most impact. What I think about is the scarcity of the skill set that we can cobble together inside of an organization. It's definitely a skill that's in high demand. It's hard to find talented people that can perform that in a way that will actually connect with business people and help them solve business problems directly. It is a unique skill. There's plenty of people that can crunch the numbers, pardon me, and build the models, but it's connecting that with context to a business problem and setting that up in a way that a business user, I think you said it perfectly earlier, that can translate that speak into business speak in a way that the business folks can understand how to apply that. I think the data is always a challenge. And it's not because we don't understand how to connect it together. I think it's just because it's prolific and it's growing, and the complexity of that data is growing. The number of sources are growing. And when I think about it as it relates to the entertainment business, just the channels that our consumers, our fans, engage with our content on is multiplying at a rapid rate. And all of those different channels generate new sources of data that we have to figure out how to mine that data and then knit it together to create a complete view of what our customers doing across those channels and where they're going in order to best, move our business forward with them. So it's really, I think, as long as the data continues to be complex, as long as the data channels continue to multiply, I think we'll always have a data challenge in trying to put that together. And then, like I said, I think just finding really good, talented people that can speak in the language of our business partners, whether they be marketers or operations people or content creators or what have you, but can really connect with them in an authentic way and then bring that perspective to the table. I think that's a unique skill. It's hard to find. I think we're gonna have to cultivate it, and that's gonna take time.
Have you?
So obviously there is a lot of challenges, right? So data obviously is a challenge in this industry. You know, data are all over the place. So it's a challenge to bring all this data together and make different data sets talk to each other and create these cross-functional data platforms. So obvious data definitely it's a challenge. So we are constantly looking for new data sources that enrich the metadata across the around the audience and around the content. And we are always looking into a way to merge different data sources that don't really talk to each other. So that's definitely a challenge, especially in this industry. You know, data is not coming from one source. The industry is changing, as everybody knows. So data is all over the place. So obviously data is a challenge. The buy-in, that was a challenge. We went past that. It took us some time, but we convinced, the traditional research people that data science is only going to help them in their everyday job. It's not meant to replace what they do. It's just an extra tool in their hands. So that was a challenge, but I think it's not anymore. Also because, now big data, advanced analytics, it's very hot. It's a big buzz, so everybody knows that it's necessary. So I would say, as a last thing, a challenge is to get good talent, right? It's very difficult to get people that make data interesting, especially working for a creative industry. So you work with people that draw South Park characters. It's very difficult to make a statistical model interesting to them, and it's very difficult to get talent that can think outside of the box. The worst thing that can happen is to hire people that are very good in executing what you tell them to do. You want to hire people that can challenge your decisions, think outside of the box, come up with new ideas every day. So, a lot of people can code in Python or whatever it is. If you speak English, that doesn't mean that you can write a book or a poem, right? Everybody knows the language, but it's very difficult to come up with something with that language that it's innovative, interesting, cool. So definitely it's tough to hire, good talent.
You're saying Carnegie Mellon University computer scientists are not the most...
I haven't interviewed anybody from them, but I'm sure they are.
All right. Completely agreed with the points about data. As much as we have wonderful advances, the data sometimes are still hard to put together. So completely agreed on that. Let me focus on the people aspects, which is maybe sort of a trickier one to mention. It has a lot to do with culture, and culture is a challenge, in other words. But I should also point out that we're actually doing okay, or more than okay, in North America, because we have an Anglo culture. For reasons that I don't necessarily totally understand, but the notion of sharing data is doing okay in an Anglo business culture. Same thing in Great Britain. It's not doing so well, for example, in Southern Europe or in parts of Asia. Also, major business centers where the notion of I have data, but my gosh, I'm not going to share it with you because the data is my power and I don't want to give up power. Okay, so if you're still in an organization where the ownership of data is equated with power, that's a problem because it creates siloisms, etc. And any effort to try to create databases is going to meet with resistance because it's going to be viewed as threatening to power structure. So we need to get rid of that. So how do we get rid of that? There's a colleague of mine has done some really interesting research on that some years ago that I just very briefly summarize. And that's the notion that if you look at data and models and data scientists, computers, and if you look at people, as in managers, executives, decision makers, if you think about it, they have actually non-overlapping skills and non-overlapping weaknesses. Okay, so in other words, they don't do the same thing. For example, humans are very, very good at integrating information and updating information very, very quickly in light of unforeseen events. If you make a prediction of how many people will go see a movie this coming Friday, and there's an earthquake on Friday morning, you might revise your prediction saying, with the earthquake now, brand new information, my prediction will probably be wrong. Okay? A computer cannot do that unless you have you have instructed the impact of an earthquake on movie attendance. So it needs to be part of the model. Okay? People also can be, as I said, very, very adaptive and very integrative. On the other hand, people are by nature sort of impulsive. They're in a good mood or in a bad mood. They are impatient. Okay, they have these characteristics which make us human, but and very, very different from machines. So, for example, you know, make a sales forecast a couple of hours after your favorite sports team has lost the game. You're in a bad mood. Okay, might affect your forecast. A computer doesn't care. Okay, so computers have a certain way of being systematic, always the same thing. Quite frankly, a little boring. Okay, because they are so predictable, very, very rigid. But very, very objective. Okay? So we're doing totally different things. And in those organizations where top management understands that and says, by bringing in data, I'm not really threatening my people or, for that matter, myself as a senior decision maker. I'm actually helping my people because I'm supplementing whatever they're weak at because they're human beings. I'm supplementing that with something that another part of the organization, you know, the data part, is very, very good at. So the notion that the two complement each other, I think, is a key element that organizations need to understand to get rid of these resistance levels. But having said that, it is, of course, totally true that in as far as models and data affect decisions that have resource implications, that you're going to see human resistance. And I see that, for example, in the CPG sector, consumer packaged goods, where you have sort of the brand people, and then you have the sales people and the channel people. And if you show, and this has happened in some instances that I'm aware of, where you show that you're putting too much emphasis on, let's say, sales promotions, and it's unprofitable, you get resistance from the sales force because that is their bread and butter. Okay? So shifting resources from one group to another group there, even though the data totally support it, may be difficult because of human resistance, because of the incentives. And in that case, what you have to do is work on the incentive system. So those are just a couple of points as I see with respect to the integration of
that
the
is,
two.
That is fascinating. So data analytics means being customer focused. So it's time for our audience to actually ask questions rather than me asking. So let's open this, and if anybody has any question for our panelists.
Oh, here we go, right up front. Hang on one sec.
Hard to see from here.
Hi, Mike Duby. I have a question, I guess one question for the folks on the corporate side, and then a question actually for the two professors. So on the corporate side, what are you guys doing to sort of get beyond the traditional data crunching? Like, for instance, with Viacom, you have a lot of different presentation properties. So often your problem is that you can't commingle data between one property and another. So how do you do you have any cool things going on that you're going to be able to start to merge that data or find insights across properties that traditionally don't want their data commingled? And then for the professors, I would say, are you thinking of sort of something like anthropology as part of your curriculum? Because we're pumping out a lot of folks who do understand data and on the sort of the sciencey side, but they don't necessarily always understand people. So is there a part of data analytics that we need to start thinking more about, like understanding people and working backwards as opposed to crunching data and going in the other direction?
Well, on the first question that you asked, I think, as we talked about earlier, the proliferation of data makes it hard to connect data together. So I think one of the biggest advances that we're trying to take advantage of is, you know, the application of machine learning and artificial intelligence to our data sets, for a couple reasons. One is, you know, to just match data together that's hard to match across different platforms because they were never designed to be matched together. But then also because I think the data itself is becoming so complex, and it's hard for an individual analyst or a business user or whomever it is that's trying to mine insights out of that data to be able to put it all together in their brain. I think that's a place where AI can be helpful in helping to surface insights or surface connections in the data that may not be necessarily obvious to an individual. So I think you know, that's, it's certainly not ready for prime time. I can't point to a big solution there, and but we are actively investing in AI technology to try to help us in that area.
I was just going to add, so for the first question, that, so from a data scientist perspective, that make things just more interesting. So the fact that we have multiple brands and that they, some of them target different audiences, so obviously it's more interesting for a data scientist just because there is more things to analyze, there is more variation across, you know, the viewing behavior. So imagine I have 15 brands that I can analyze. Imagine if I had only one. So it makes things only more interesting. Obviously, I can come up with insights that are difficult to receive from the brands, but that I can deal with that later. From a statistician, that's just more exciting, you know?
Yes, and then I guess for me the question was on the training side. First of all, I agree with the premise that data science practitioners should be trained in team building skills and communication, etc. I can't really answer the question very well at the undergraduate level because at UCLA I only teach MBAs and PhDs. But at the graduate level, we definitely do. So no matter how many courses you take in statistics or econometrics or whatnot, you will have to go through team building exercises, leadership courses, courses where you get self-diagnosed on your personal management style and what you need to work on, and so communications courses, etc. So we do that very, very much so at the graduate level. Maybe you can add some perspective.
So, I mean, we hear this, I mean, actually four times in this panel I heard that we want people who are not just good coders, but also they have an ability to convert that code into English or be able to connect with people. So I'm actually part of a committee in the university which is looking at the undergraduate programs, especially in the information technology and computer science. And one of the elements that everybody wants, or at least thinking very deeply about, is that our graduates, they have to be excellent technically, because that's really important. Otherwise, you know, they're not going to be very successful. But at the same time, they need to be able to have a deeper understanding of what the technology means, and not just what the technology means at a people level, but also what does the technology mean at a societal level? What are some of the ethical challenges you talk about? So think about, you know, you're collecting lots and lots of data so that you can be, you know, you can create the technology platform to target people very effectively. But then what about the privacy challenges? What about, you know, how can we get them to appreciate? So there's a lot of, you know, particular effort going on that within their core curriculum, beyond the technical courses, we have to force them to take some of the classes, or maybe we have to create some of those classes, which leave them with that deeper appreciation that technology by itself is not solution, and you have to know and understand this in great detail. So I think the universities are responding to the market demand and hopefully will produce graduates which are more suitable for the work than in the past, maybe. Any other questions?
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time.
Oh, okay.
DigiMark, next time. But you guys are sticking around, right? We'll have a drink later after the